The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to a special election edition of the Tech Weekly podcast from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. The UK is heading to the polling booths to vote for its new parliament on the 6th of May. This year, the main parties have made Britain's digital future a central issue in their election promises, releasing technology manifestos and making speeches about how they'll promote the country's thriving technology industry. We want to know just what each party plans for the digital economy, how they'll curb piracy and file sharing, where they stand on intellectual property copyright reforms, how they'll fund rural broadband penetration, and what they intend to do with the library of government data. Joining me in the studio are Stephen Timms, Labour MP for East Ham, Financial Secretary to the Treasury and Minister for Digital Britain, Jeremy Hunt, Conservative MP for South West Surrey and Shadow Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport, and Lord Razzle, the Liberal Democrat spokesperson for business, enterprise and regulatory reform. Welcome, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining us. Stephen Timms, I think the first question really has to be Mac or PC?
PC.
Why PC?
I think just because I've always used one, although I must admit to admiring the Macs used by some of my friends, but I've stuck with a PC.
Jeremy Hunt, Mac or PC?
I am PC as well, although I'm an aspiring iPhone user, so I'm kind of, you know, I'm waiting to get rid of my current mobile phone because everyone who's got an iPhone says they're so amazing, I feel very left out.
Lord Razzle, your turn, Mac or PC?
I'd say PC. Couple to BlackBerry.
I see. Yeah. Well, joining me.
Did you know, Alex, by the way, in America they say that Democrats have iPhones and Republicans have BlackBerries?
I did not know that. I will put that into my file of facts for future, for future statistics.
In this country, it's the other way around.
Well, also in the studio are our Tech Weekly team, Guardian Technology editor Charles Arthur, and new media correspondent Jemima Kish. Welcome. It's going to be a packed hour of discussion on Tech Weekly. In addition to our own interests, we've lobbied our listeners for their questions for this debate via Twitter and The Guardian's blogs. Keep listening for the next 60 minutes to learn more about what's behind the technology election promises and what will happen in digital Britain over the next 5 years. The general election of 2010 has been dubbed the digital election, both in process and practice. Not only do all the parties have substantial presences on social networking sites and across the web, they've made their intentions for the future of a digital Britain clear. The clearest election promises have been outlined in the government's controversial Digital Economy Act, passed in Parliament amid significant outcry at the beginning of April. In a moment, the thoughts of UK Music's Fergal Sharkey and Jim Killick of the Open Rights Group from a Tech Weekly from a fortnight ago, as well as Labour MP Tom Watson. But first, here's how the vote in Parliament was reported on Guardian Daily.
The Digital Economy Bill is rushed through Parliament as it shuts up shop for the general election.
The two things I always say about legislation, you should never do it in haste. And when the political parties agree on something, there's no proper scrutiny taking place.
The history of these sorts of programmes everywhere else has been that it's done absolutely nothing to reduce copyright infringement. Copyright infringement in France has gone up.
To what extent do you think that this issue is going to be an election issue?
I don't think it is. People actually, I think, realise and are very happy to accept we need to create an environment where people can get paid who wish to get paid for their time and effort.
It already is an election issue and we're doing an absolute best to make sure it will be an extremely large election issue for a very large number of MPs.
That was Jim Killick from the Open Rights Group and Fergal Sharkey from UK Music debating whether the Digital Economy Act would be a centre stage issue in this general election. And in fact, the DEA's thrust into the limelight has taken many candidates by surprise who had not anticipated the outrage on social networking services like Twitter. One of the key promises of the Conservatives, Jeremy Hunt, is that you will drop any, quote, flawed legislation from the DEA if you do win the election. What would that be and when would you do that?
Well, we've said we will review what is in the Digital Economy Act and reserve the right to change anything if we win the next election that we don't think is appropriate. And I think the most controversial part of the Act is the bit around piracy. And what we've always said on that is that you need to have a functioning market on the internet. You need to be able to buy and sell digital property. And at the moment, you can't have that because piracy is rife, and that is very disruptive for the creative industries. But at the same time, you need a structure that doesn't discourage innovation and new business models emerging. And the Digital Economy Act is an attempt to try and strike that balance. I think that there may well turn out to be some things that don't work in it. And I think if we'd had proper scrutiny in the House of Commons, and particularly if we'd had a committee stage where we could have gone through it line by line, clause by clause, and actually discussed some of the elements of it, then some of the things that the Open Rights Group, for example, are concerned about could have had a much better airing. And I think it's a great shame because it's difficult to get this kind of legislation on the statute book. And had the government done it just a few months earlier, and I think there would have been time in the parliamentary process, then we could have had a much fuller debate and hopefully got some better legislation.
But surely Ed Vasey was, I think it was Ed Vasey who stood up and basically taunted the Labour benches who are complaining about it and said, well, you know, if you'd done this a bit better, then you could have had it reviewed. But Ed Vasey surely was the one who helped to get it whipped through and to actually get it put into an act.
Well, the Conservative Party took a view that there are lots of things in this act or bill as it was that are very important. For example, the video games classification system is incredibly important for parents who want to know what video games are safe to buy for their children. For example, the elements to do with apportioning radio spectrum are very important to the commercial radio industry. And I think the principle of trying to do something to combat piracy is a very important one as well. But we probably could have had better legislation if we'd had better scrutiny. And I think that's the shame of the Act and what's upset so many people.
Lord Razzle, the Liberal Democrats have been vocal about their opposition to the Digital Economy Act as well. And as Jeremy Hunt is saying, we need to create issues, we need to create infrastructure so that we can stop file sharing and piracy. How would the Liberal Democrats change this bill in such a way that we still retain that very important aspect?
Well, let me go back to your first premise. We supported this bill when it came through the House of Lords. And I must say, having got scars on my back of the many days of scrutiny line by line that this bill was subjected to in the House of Lords, I do find it slightly amusing when members of Parliament say it would have been a better bill had it had proper scrutiny, because when bills get to the House of Commons, normally they're guillotined, even if there isn't an election coming up, and a lot less time is spent on proper scrutiny. And that's, of course, why the government started in the House of Lords, where it does get bills get much better scrutiny there. I think the problem, and where I entirely agree with Jeremy Hunt, is that the government started this far too late. I mean, the industry, the music industry, the film industry, have been campaigning for years to have something done on these issues. And then we find a bill coming in when towards the end of a parliamentary a process. But where I agree with, and we in the end in the House of Commons didn't support it, not on the grounds that we were against the bill, but we thought that you shouldn't make complicated legislation like this rushed through in the House of Commons at the last minute without even a committee stage. So what we would do, exactly what Jeremy Hunt is saying, I think we need to see how, if we're playing a role in the future governance of this country, we would want to do what the Tories want to do, is see how it's working in practice, and if necessary, bring back further legislation to amend it. Let's take one of the controversial issues, which is peer-to-peer file sharing. We don't yet know what Ofcom's proposals in detail are going to be. We don't know how they're going to work in practice. We don't know what the proposals will be under which people get turned off. All of those issues that were raised, and I think it will behove legislators to really look at how this works in practice and not allow the pressures of government time to squeeze out this necessary legislative review.
Stephen Timms, I'd like to come to you now and look at what consultation it was that you took in terms of the development of this bill. Can you talk me through who it was that you spoke with and what influence ultimately they had on the development?
Mm. Well, we talked to lots of people. We published the Digital Britain report in June of last year. We made some further proposals in this area over the summer, consulted on those. One of the important things that we did in the bill, partly reflecting the fact that the debate was a curtailed one in the Commons, was to ensure that much of the detailed work will be in regulations which will follow, which will be consulted on further. And in fact, we've ensured they'll be consulted on with what's called a super affirmative procedure, which means there'll be more consultation than normal and more opportunity to change them than there would be in a conventional parliamentary process. So there's a lot more consultation still to come about the detail beyond the work that we've already done. I was a little bit surprised to hear Jeremy wobbling somewhat, because, I mean, actually, as you rightly pointed out, Ed Vasey and the Conservative Party front bench generally took a very robust position on this in the debate. I think they were right to do so. I think this was an area where action was required.
Are you happy with it?
Yes. I think the bill will stand the test of time and of experience. As I say, there's a lot of detailed work still to be done on the regulations, but the framework which is now in place, I think, is right.
But do you acknowledge that there is an enormous digital constituency out there, people that have incredibly insightful knowledge and understanding of the internet and internet culture and the web services that we all use every day? And those people felt enormously disenfranchised by the decisions that were made and by a lobbying process that sounded a bill that very much reflected the interests of the strongest lobbyists in Parliament, so the BPI and those creative industries, which are very strong. But there's incredible outrage about this in the technical community, and it's almost hard to sum that up. Were you surprised by that?
First of all, I agree with you. There certainly was a very, very deep and widespread concern. I've only been on Twitter since January, and I've never experienced anything like the sort of pages and pages of tweets which were sent in my direction. Particularly in actually during the debate, people were tweeting, and I found it very interesting and in some ways a pretty disconcerting process to be on the receiving end of that. But of course, at the other side, there was an equally large group of people, as far as I can see, although not represented on Twitter, who were desperately anxious that action should be taken to deal with what is now a very big problem for our creative industries, which, you know, account for more of the British economy than is the case in any other country in the world. And in the end, government had to decide, do we act or not? We decided to act. And I think that was right.
Why did you act so late in the day, though?
The Digital Britain report was published last June. The question was, did we then act or not? I think it was right. I mean, you know, some governments run out of steam. We didn't. There were lots of things we wanted to do.
It's a bit of a travesty that something so important was rushed through at the last minute.
Actually, as I say, I think this will stand up to the test of subsequent scrutiny, because the debate itself, we had a short debate in the Commons, but it was a good second reading debate, 12 speeches roughly in favour of what we were doing in the controversial areas, 8 against. And, you know, I think, and some of those speeches were very thoughtful and interesting. And that the question of principle for the Commons was, are we going to proceed with this legislation or pull out of it? The Conservatives could have insisted on dropping these controversial clauses. They did insist on dropping a couple of them. They said, I think rightly, that these should stay in. There is now a lot of detailed work, and there will need to be a lot of careful consultation with exactly the people who sent all those tweets. And indeed, one of my tweets after the bill going out was to say to people, look, you know, can't we have a sensible conversation between those who feel outraged and those who feel it's absolutely essential that we do this? Because I think the lack of that conversation in the past has been one of the problems.
But I think where your point is very valid is over what started off as Clause 17 in the bill, which the government put in, which would have, in the original bill, which would have effectively meant that government could have amended copyright law in the future by regulation. Now, it was blindingly apparent from the start that that was never going to carry the House of Lords, and it probably wouldn't have carried the House of Commons. But as a result, because of the time pressure, we had all sorts of proposals to deal with website blocking that never really got proper scrutiny at all. They didn't really get scrutiny in the House of Lords, even, let alone, and obviously not in. And that's an area which we really do need to watch and see how the implementation of that is working, because that's an area that did not get proper scrutiny.
And indeed, that's an area. The single biggest point of concern for people.
The file sharing peer to peer stuff got a lot of scrutiny.
And
I suspect we've ended up with a proposal that is probably will turn, as Stephen Timm said, will stand the test of time. But I'm not sure the website blocking stuff will.
We will be discussing copyright in a moment, but I wanted to wrap up this idea of file sharing and piracy and ask each of you, starting with Stephen Timms, do you think that the measures that are outlined in the DEA will stop piracy or reduce it?
I certainly think they'll reduce it. I mean, initially, what the legislation enables is copyright holders to request from ISPs that they send letters to people who they find are unlawfully downloading their copyright material. And I think that simply sending out those letters is going to have quite a big impact. And I hope, actually, that will do the trick. Our aim is to reduce the scale of the problem by 70%. I hope simply sending out those letters will do that. If not, then we will have to look at the technical measures which the bill enables regulations to be made for, but does not itself enact.
Jeremy Hunt.
Well, I think the bill is trying to do the right thing, but I think we'll only find out in the course of time as to whether it's effective. And I think one of the areas that's concerned a lot of people in the online community is that the regulations could be used, for example, to punish organisers of Wi-Fi hotspots, internet cafes and so on. And that's an example. I actually agree with Tim. I think the House of Lords did some very good scrutiny. But that's an example of where some more scrutiny by the House of Commons could have put people's minds at rest, because the government, Stephen advised us privately that he thought that that wasn't an issue because the regulations could be constructed in such a way that would make sure that internet cafes and Wi-Fi hotspots weren't affected. But actually, I think if we'd had that debate publicly in a committee stage in the House of Commons, then we could have made those public assurances. And I think that's why, I really hope this legislation does work, but I think we could have made it better than it is, and I think that is the shame with rushing it through in the way that happened.
Lord Razzle, what do you think on this? Will this serve to reduce piracy, stop it, or will it simply drive it underground?
I think as far as the peer-to-peer file sharing, I think it will reduce piracy. I think it would have been a lot better had we seen in advance draft regulations, draft proposals from Ofcom, so would actually know what those are going to be. As far as the website blocking, I am concerned that that will drive it further underground. I know the Secret Service allegedly are worried that this will cause more encryption, which etc., etc., etc. So I'm worried about that area, but I think the peer-to-peer file sharing, I think we've got a satisfactory compromise which will reduce piracy.
But Tim, I think it was your colleagues in the House of Lords who moved the site blocking proposal.
Not the one that we ended up with.
It was you and the Conservatives, yes. against Labour members of the House.
Yes,
of
and then you came up with another proposal.
Oh, indeed.
Yes, okay.
All right, we could go back and forth. One final question on this, again asked by one of our readers. Can the service providers and downloaders be assured of an innocent until proven guilty approach if you're remaking the legislation or if you're making the regulations? Just one word answer, Stephen Timms.
I can't do it in one word. I mean, there will be a robust appeal mechanism in place. Nothing will happen until the appeal is determined. But it's a bit like issuing a parking ticket or something.
Okay. Jim Hunt?
Well, I think the principle of innocent until proven guilty is a fundamental one, and we have to make sure that the regulations reflect that in the way these measures are implemented.
Tim Razzle?
Yes, I mean, we fought for that very much in the House of Lords, and I think hopefully that it will be implemented in the regulations.
As we've already spoken about, the important underlying issue that the Digital Economy Act seeks to regulate is copyright theft. As a recent guest to Tech Weekly argues, the notion of copyright that's detailed in the Act suggests a hidden form of government control. And here's Heather Brook, a Freedom of Information Rights campaigner and the woman who broke the MP's expenses scandal in 2009.
This emphasis on copyright and the idea that you can copyright public information is very insidious, because that's just another form of censorship. And that's how people need to start thinking about copyright. I mean, it's all very well to say we need to provide people with a living, but copyright has moved vastly away from that. And now what it's being used for is just either usurious greed or anti-competitive practices or censorship. And it strikes me that copyright in that Digital Economy Bill Act is a lot to do with stopping people from using information for the betterment of society as a whole.
Stephen Timms, how does the government's understanding of copyright need to change for a digital age?
I think the Digital Economy Act is about a very different area from the one that we've just heard about. It's essentially about protecting our creative industries, music, film, independent TV production, computer games, software, a bigger proportion of the UK economy than of any other country in the world, and at the moment suffering significant detriment because people are accessing their products without paying for them. And so I see copyright essentially as a mechanism for protecting them and assuring them that if they invest in the kind of great content that in Britain we're very good at producing, then you can expect a reasonable return in payment as a consequence.
And do you recognise that P2P and file sharing is a very important technology and one that can and should be used legally as well?
It's important not
to outlaw that as a technology.
Quite right.
So how, Lord Razzle, would you integrate a peer-to-peer or file-sharing principle with this idea, with this new notion of how we have to conceptualise copyright in a digital age?
Well, I thought that the commentator, I completely disagree with what she said. I don't think it's got anything to do with censorship. And I think what we have to... There has a huge education process necessary at the moment. I would suspect that most people from 13 to 21 think they're perfectly entitled to have anything free because the internet is free, so why can't they have copyright material free? And it has to be explained why that is. We won't have creative industries, we won't have the music industry, we won't have the film industry if everybody can simply take it for nothing. Now, if that's what people want, and if they regard the copyright in Lily Allen's new song as censorship to that she has the copyright in it, well, Lily Allen won't sing any songs. I mean, she might go on tour and you can go to O2 and hear her, but she's not going to try and launch records or do that.
But there's a wider shift in business models here, though. In China, where piracy is so rife, it's actually impossible to do anything about it. Musicians make their money instead from their personal appearances and their live gigs, and there's a discussion to be had about the bigger shift in
the
industry.
Well, I mean, I deliberately used Lily Allen, who's been quite articulate on this topic, because, of course, you're right, which is that if you're Elton John or indeed Lily Allen, you can make a lot of money out of going and doing a live gig, and indeed, this whole process developed over the last 5-10 years, we find that the bands do a lot more on the road rather than recording music. But that doesn't apply to the young creative bands who are starting out. They need the protection of copyright in order to be able to protect themselves before they make their name. Elton John sells his records and then can go out on tour. But if there was no copyright, we would never have heard of Elton John.
I don't know. I'm not sure if I agree with that, because I think Alex Turner and the Arctic Monkeys were handing out free CDs of their gigs at the gigs, and then people were going and singing the songs.
Yes, but they were making a huge promotion of it, weren't they?
Well, that was sort of
Gordon Brown discovered that he wanted to listen to the Arctic Monkeys. Now somebody must have told him, so there must have been promotion.
Can I just say, I think there is a world of difference between a young artist or even Lily Allen producing a piece of music or any type of digital content and saying, I'm going to put this online and sell it to anyone who wants to buy it. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. And I think, to be honest, it is the artist's choice how they want to distribute their material, and it must be. There's a world of difference between that and the record industry wanting to protect an old business model where they used to make a lot of money from selling CDs for 15 quid, which they're not making anymore because business models have changed. And I think it is the government's job to protect the artist. It's not the government's job to protect any particular business model that the record industry has been used to pursuing. And I think it's very important we get that distinction right.
No, I agree.
But
I
Jeremy Hunt, how would you articulate that in terms of copyright, in terms of, you know, these young people who are going out and they're giving away their free CDs? They're self-promoting by allowing their content to go out and be mashed up. There's a different copyright philosophy, as Lord Razzle mentioned, in this age group. So how would you and the Conservative Party conceptualise copyright in this new digital age?
Well, I think if people want to promote themselves by doing that, then I think that is their choice. I think mashups are great, and I think the last thing we want to be doing is prosecuting someone who does a birthday video of their six-year-old daughter using some soundtrack from the Beatles. And I think there's a very big difference between commercial and non-commercial use, and I think that a proper review of copyright law, which is what the Conservatives are committed to doing if we win the next election, actually will recognise the difference between commercial and non-commercial use and will try and create a light-touch structure that allows the creativity, which is what the internet is all about, but at the same time recognises the right of artists and creators to get a return from their content. And it's not easy to do. I think, in fact, one of the sort of missed opportunities of this bill is that it could have had a much wider look at copyright law in the digital age.
And we, of course, tend to focus on music, and we've done so in this conversation. But what about books with the new technology? I mean, what about Kindle and all of that? you know, if you're a novelist writing your first novel, you've got to have copyright protection.
Well, in that case, surely you're then talking about Google, aren't you? Which is
and Google, you're coming into that market,
copying people's books and sticking them on machines. But possibly a more focused question, perhaps, would be about copyright term, because I think Andrew Gowers led a review of copyright during this Parliament that's just finished, and there was the question of how long copyright should subsist in items, whether it should be, you know, the life of the author plus another 70 years. And there have been suggestions by, I think, Rufus Pollock, for example, who the Conservatives have used for other calculations, has suggested that actually an ideal term for copyright is 14 years or so. Perhaps could we just go around very briefly and ask Stephen Timms, do you think copyright terms should be shortened, lengthened? Is it just right as it is?
Well, our conclusion from that work was that we should leave it as it is. I remember people like Cliff Richard arguing very strongly it should be much longer. I think the balance at the moment is about right. But there is a review underway and there are some big questions here for the future, I think.
Who's doing that review?
David Lammy has been leading it for us. I think what is absolutely right is to criticise music industry and others for being so slow to develop the kind of business models that can survive and prosper in the digital age. They have been slow and they need to move fast now.
I'd just like to follow up what Stephen has said about these new business models, because I think one of the best examples of a new business model is Spotify, which is used by millions of people and is a really good example of a new business model that's really taken off. And I remember meeting, as part of my research for the Digital Economy Act, the guy who founded Spotify, Daniel Ek. And he said to me, look, you have to do something about illegal peer-to-peer file sharing. So I'm getting muddled up here. You have to do something about it because the new business models cannot survive, however brilliant they are, if someone else is offering the same thing free. And so he said that Spotify only started to take off when similar measures to what's in the Digital Economy Act were introduced in Sweden. And that was the moment at which people started flocking to the legal alternative. And so I think we have to recognise if we want these new business models that the law does have to come in somewhere. We can't just wash our hands and say, you know, we're going to allow unlimited piracy.
Fair enough. Though the way we've dealt with the DEA, I mean, on the copyright term question, shorter, longer, as it is?
We've actually supported a small extension of the term, but I think the most important thing here is to try and get something that is agreed between Europe and America so that basically all the major economies are operating under the same system. And so people might say unusually for the Conservative Party, but we actually support what the EU is saying, which is a small extension on what we've got in the UK at the moment.
Yeah, I think so do we. Of course, we've got to remember what the driver for this extension of copyright is. That rock and roll started in, let's say, 1957, 58. So there are huge numbers of the early rock and roll artists who are still records very much in demand are about or have or about to come out of copyright, and that's where the real driver for the music industry for this extension comes from.
We've got to pay for that chalet in Bermuda somehow.
Exactly.
As we've already alluded, the punishment for infringement would be to go onto a blacklist under the Digital Economy Act, and the problems associated with setting up website blacklists, which is one of these proposed solutions, these have precursors around the world, most notably in Australia. Here's how ABC in Australia have reported their country's web filter.
In Washington, the State Department has raised concerns over the Rudd government's internet filtering legislation.
Armed with computer engineers, outspoken euthanasia advocate Philip Nitschke's travelling the country to teach followers how to get around the government's proposed internet filter. If the government's successful, sites like the Peaceful Pill will be deemed illegal, refused classification, and blocked from Australian computers.
Stephen Timms, how will a Labor government crack down on the people who will now turn to encryption, as is the case in Australia, in order to help go uncovered when file sharing?
Well, again, the detail will be in regulations, which we will have to consult very widely on. And I don't think that the measures in the bill will be an absolutely watertight way of making sure nobody ever gets to a website with copyright material on which is being given away by somebody without payment. But what I think we can do is significantly raise the barrier which has to be crossed to access that material. And actually, we've got very good experience in the UK of website blocking in one particular area. That's through the work of Internet Watch Foundation. So we know that can be effective, and I think we'll need to pay heed to the lessons from that experience when we draw up the regulations for the site blocking element of the Digital Economy Act.
Jeremy Hunt, how would the Conservatives decide which sites are blocked? Would they work with organisations like Internet Watch, or would you create your own legislation, your own approach?
Well, I think the first thing to say is I think Stephen's right, that you are never going to solve 100% of this problem. And I think we have to recognise that, you know, good can be the enemy of the best in this situation, and as Stephen says, you're trying to raise the bar. But nonetheless, it is possible to do to make some progress. And you know, in the case of, for example, paedophile websites, it is of course possible if someone really wanted to, they could search around and find a paedophile website somewhere. But actually, the system we have makes it a lot more difficult, and I think that's a good thing. I think that what we've got to be very, very careful about in this whole site blocking process is that there is absolutely no compromise or risk to freedom of expression, because that is one of the most important things that the internet makes possible. And so we asked the government in this site blocking legislation, and the government, to its credit, agreed that we should explicitly say that nothing in this site blocking legislation should compromise freedom of expression. So then you get to the question of how you decide what sites are going to be on this list. And I think that this has to be done independently of politicians through a judicial process, so that you have a court deciding that a site is promoting the infringement of copyright. And I think only if there is a clear judicial process, completely independent of politicians and lobbyists, then will the public have confidence that this is a fair process.
Lord Brazel, how would be the arbiters of this good taste website
list? I agree with Jeremy Hunt, and of course this is the area.
I agree with Jeremy.
This is amazing.
I'm going to have a yellow T-shirt saying I agree with Jeremy. But this is the point we were discussing earlier. This is why it is absolutely imperative that this legislation is kept under constant review to establish whether it is working. And of course, it's never going to be perfect. Nobody's ever going to catch every site, but we have to see how it progresses.
It isn't anything about bad taste, just so this is clear. What would happen? A copyright holder will apply for a court order to block a site which is providing their own material.
But the danger, as you said, is encryption. You know, what happens if it's encrypted, you know, and so on, which is we have to keep an eye on.
On the other side of the data debate is the campaign pledge by the parties to make more government data easily accessible to the public. Labour has made headway this year when they released the ordnance survey data and other public records, a proposal spearheaded by the scientist who invented the World Wide Web, Sir Tim Berners-Lee.
Well, in 2009, I felt that it was going to be a year when I would try to persuade people to put data on the web. And then later in May or June, there was a lunch at Chequers, and the Prime Minister asked me what the UK government should do to make the best use of the internet, and I said, well, put all your government data on the web. And he said, okay, let's do it.
Stephen Timms, you opened up the Ordnance Survey, the OS data this year, and some of the other government databases as well. Do you feel that you've gone far enough? What's next?
Well, we're certainly making progress, and we've got a lot of data sets now on the data.gov.uk website, and people are saying, actually, we've done a better job than the US, and Barack Obama, of course, has made a lot of headway in this area as well. But there's more that needs to be done, and what we have to do is keep on adding to those data sets and just watching people use that data and developing applications with it. I think the sky is the limit for the potential that's ahead.
But you're not specifying at all. I mean, we'll come to Jeremy Hunt in a moment, but for example, there's Environment Agency data about flood maps, there's the postcode address file, which is very useful to people. There's been a sort of sense that the opening up that was done just before the announcement of the election has sort of been a little bit, but you know, that it feels like a sort of a almost a tentative first step in making what was very proprietary data free for commercial use. Is the feeling in the Labour Party that, well, that's enough? Do you have other targets in view?
Yeah, no, I think there is a lot more to be done. I mean, the big prize of the people that I spoke to was the Ordnance Survey data, because so much of what you can do with data is, if you've got the geographical data there as well, you can do a lot more with it. That's been a very big step. But I agree with you about some of the other data sets, flood information. I see no reason at all why that shouldn't be online. And we need to go department by department searching for data. And if there isn't a good reason for it not to be online, then it should be.
Jeremy Hunt, the Conservatives have outlined very clearly in their technology manifesto that you are interested in opening up more data. What's interesting, though, is that you're interested in taking it, looking at it from a parliamentary perspective, aren't you? You're interested in saying, right, well, public officials will open up their data, as opposed to carrying on with what Labour has done, opening up the public data, things like the flood databases. Is this the case?
No, not at all. We want to have a presumption that all data is open to the public unless there's a very, very strong reason not to. We'd like to turn that presumption around. Instead of saying, what could we let the public see, we'd like to say, what should we not let the public see, and have a much smaller group of things. And I think there's got to be a big change in mindset in all our public organisations, because I think what tends to happen at the moment, when you've got stuff like the flood information, public bodies tend to think, well, this is valuable and I want to maximise this value, maybe so I can get some money back for the taxpayer or whatever. And I think we've got to recognise there is public value in letting the public look at this data, analyse it, parse it, do things that you're not expecting with it, which is as important, if not more important, than a few pounds that you could raise from selling that data to different people. And the reason for that is because, and I think this is Tim Berners-Lee's insight, is that we just don't know what value people will find in this data. And what we need to do is to tap into the genius of the millions of people who use the internet and the strange insights that they might have and the creative thinking they will have. And they will use that data in ways that is to the benefit of all of us.
In the Tory manifesto, you talk about £6 billion of potential worth in opening up government data based on Rufus Pollock's analysis, which I think goes back to the Cambridge Econometrics study. That study, though, was looking at opening up, for example, with Ordnance Survey, opening up everything in it, including the master map, which has not been opened up under the Labour proposals. Are you saying that a Tory government would make the master map free?
Well, in principle, yes. I don't want to sort of, because I don't know about that particular issue in detail, right. But in principle, that's exactly what we're saying, that we want to take all these government data sets and instead of trying to predict where the value is, say, well, let's make them public and let's see what the public can make of them, because there will be people who do some brilliant things that officials, ministers never even thought of. And we want to try and tap into that creativity for the benefit of everyone.
The problem then is how you fund the work of the Ordnance Survey. And the Ordnance Survey produces very good quality maps by international comparison. It needs serious funding to enable it to do that. Get maps like that are not available in the US, for example.
And I think it would be about £100 million a year, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I just say to that, look at what Google did with Google Maps. I mean, the reality
They licensed it from Teleatlas, who I think had licensed it from Ordnance Survey.
Yeah, but the thing about Google Maps is that they found that actually, that's for the UK, but they found that actually making this data available is something that's worked for them commercially, and there is some value in it, and there's lots of value in Google Maps that Google didn't predict at the outset, and I think that's why we've got to change our mindset about this public data.
Lord Razzle, we have clearly, the Conservatives and Labour have been very vocal about this issue, but as one of our readers, Terry Broad, comments, we don't yet know what the Liberal Democrats think about this issue. What will you do?
Well, I mean, I don't think there's any disagreement here. What I think is that this is about government structure. I think that this will not happen, whoever forms the next government, unless there is a big hitter in the job who takes as a primary responsibility driving this through. I mean, it won't work if this is just tacked on to a minister who has this as one of the 25 other responsibilities they have. So, I think that's actually the lesson of the whole Digital Britain debate. You've got to have somebody who really, lies in the bath and thinks what he's going to do next or she's going to do next, rather than all the other 25 things they've got to do next.
It's a very good point. Who would be lined up as Minister for Technology?
Quite. Well, I depends who's going to win the election, doesn't it?
Yeah. I hope it will be me if the Conservatives win, because I think it's a really, really interesting.
But I mean, if it is Jeremy, he's going to have 25 other things to do. That's the point. And structuring it in such a way that there's somebody in government with influence who will drive this through will be essential if it's going to happen in the way everybody wants it to happen.
So basically, you're looking to give Tim Berners-Lee a sort of a life employment.
I don't think it'll be Alan Sugar.
Well, these issues...
Tom Watson did a great job on this.
Yes, he has done. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, these issues will continue to be relevant as the UK becomes a fully wired nation. Labour and the Conservatives have outlined their intention to distribute super-fast broadband to rural areas in order to ensure digital inclusion. Here's Gordon Brown, for example, outlining the government's plan on the 22nd of March.
Super-fast broadband is the electricity of the digital age, and I believe it must be for all and not just for some. If every household is to benefit, then it is fair that every household contribute to meeting this goal. And that is why we have chosen to raise a small levy on each household's phone line, 50 pence per month, about the price of a pint of milk, to help fund a partnership with the private sector. 50 pence a month for a super fast broadband network right across Britain.
Now, according to your technology manifestos, Jeremy Hunt and Stephen Timms, the Tory policy favours establishing broadband first in urban areas, while Labour policy favours the countryside. Lord Razzle, we don't yet know from the Liberal Democrats. What is your policy? How do you intend to distribute broadband?
Well, we've supported the government on the Gordon Brown's point. I mean, we've got obviously the devil, like all these things, is in the detail. We think we need to look at protecting old age pensioners. We need to protect. But basically, we've supported the levy.
How will you get super fast broadband out to the sticks, Jeremy Hunt?
Well, can I just slightly correct what you said there? Because we haven't said that we want it to go to the cities first. What we've said is that this needs to be a two-pronged approach. We need to completely overhaul the regulatory structure to stimulate investment by the private sector to get super-fast broadband rolled out in the 60% of the country that's covered by the towns and cities. And I think this is a big missed opportunity in the Digital Economy Act, because I think the way we should do that is by breaking open BT's monopoly on infrastructure and allowing other providers to lay fibre in BT's ducts and pipes and on their telegraph poles and in the sewers and in the water mains and on electricity pylons. And there was a huge opportunity to make that possible in the Digital Economy Act. And that will help not just the towns and cities, but it'll also help the countryside, because the countryside is near a town, and so they'll have a big, fast network near them. But we've always said that there will be parts of the country that the market won't provide for.
But surely that's why you need a subsidy in those parts of the country where it's very expensive to put down the fibre, and the fibre is extremely expensive. And a market-driven system won't do that.
I agree with you entirely, and that's why we think that it will be necessary to have an element of subsidy. We don't like the 50p phone tax the government are proposing, because that actually will put some people off taking up broadband. We've said that there's a switchover surplus on the BBC licence fee, and there's a levy on the BBC licence fee at the moment for digital switchover, which lasts until 2012. We would continue that levy on the licence fee to fund broadband in rural areas, and we think that is a less distorting way of doing it, and that would have the benefit of not putting people off connecting to broadband in the first place. And it's also interesting, something the BBC themselves think is a reasonable thing to do, for the very simple reason that some of the hungriest consumers of bandwidth are people who use the iPlayer. And the BBC want to make sure that everyone has access to the iPlayer. So, I think it's a combination. But I think the shame of this bill is that we could have been much more bold and radical in getting measures through that would stimulate private sector investment in the parts of the country.
But with regards to that, how do you ensure, if it's a market-driven economy, if it's a market-driven plan, how do you ensure that the net remains neutral, so that people are not buying up sites or disallowing access or cutting off access because they happen to be the highest bidder?
Because what you would do is you would simply have a system whereby anyone who laid fibre would have an obligation to wholesale the fibre they've laid to anyone who wants it. It's a system that they have in France, for example, and it's a system they have in Singapore, and it's a system they have in Korea, all countries that are making much faster progress in laying a super fast broadband network
which
than we are.
But which are much denser. They have fewer people in rural areas than we do.
Well, not France, not parts of America that are laying fibre, but it's true. Places like Korea, you have large proportions of the population living in urban areas and living in flats, and they managed to do it with only with 95% of the investment coming from the private sector. We might not be able to manage that because we have more rural areas.
Stephen Timms, the Labour proposals would actually benefit Tory voters because they're the ones in the showers.
They'll certainly benefit rural areas. I mean, the problem with the funding source that Jeremy's described, as he acknowledged, I think, is that the money won't be available till 2013. That's too late. We've really got to get a move on with this. By the end of this year, Virgin Media will be able to support 100 megabits per second across its entire network, serving only urban areas. Now, if that's what customers in urban areas are demanding, and it is, to say that we're not going to do anything about rural areas for another 3 years simply isn't good enough. There are rural schools, rural businesses, which need to be able to compete. And to do that, they need a next generation.
It isn't good enough, but it's not what we're saying. I mean, there is actually a surplus in the digital switchover money that has been designated from the BBC licence fee for digital switchover that isn't going to be used up. So we could use that money. Now, you want to use it for other things, but we think we could use it for super fast broadband in rural areas.
It's being used for digital switchover. It's also being used for the universal service, 2 megabits per second by 2012. There's not much left beyond that. You need 150 million a year to make some progress on this, and that's what the 50p a month levy will provide.
You want to use it, Stephen, to subsidise regional news from ITV. We don't want to do that. We'd rather that money was used for rural broadband.
Stephen Timms, you mentioned the 2 megabits per second. Yeah. Why are you setting your sights so low when you've got an international community that's a heck of a lot faster?
Because at the moment there are about 10% of UK households that can't get access to any broadband service at all. We're saying we need to make sure everybody has access to a basic broadband service. That's going to take us until about 2012. But beyond that, we need to get a move on and provide next-generation broadband as quickly as possible, including in rural areas.
Jeremy Hunt.
I think that the most important thing for super-fast broadband is, I agree with Stephen entirely, we've got to get a move on. But I think that we need to be much more radical in our approach to this. And I think that it's very interesting if you look at all the countries that have made progress in super-fast broadband. They've done it because they haven't relied on a PTT, on the national telecoms operator, to lay the fibre throughout the country. They've actually harnessed other private sector players. And I think the mistake that we're making in the UK at the moment is that we're relying on BT to do this. Now, government's own studies say that this could cost up to £29 billion of investment. That is not something that one company can afford on its own. I think it would have been great if we could have seen in this Digital Economy Act something that would have made it possible, for example, for Virgin to do more, for Sky to do more, for Carphone Warehouse to use our pylons, our telegraph poles, our ducts, our sewers, and that way would have stimulated a lot more investment than we're doing at the moment.
Lord Razzle, are we setting our sights too low in terms of the potential for the speed of the broadband?
No, I think what we are doing is highlighting, as Jeremy has indicated, the issue with BT. I mean, BT is still highly dominant in this area. Now, Stephen Timms is, of course, right that there are other players.
Virgin Media has driven
this. Yes, I understand that. But what the area that I worry about, the Tory proposals, is I'm always concerned about the idea of starting taking money away from the licence fee. Now, I know, because once you go down that route, governments being governments, will go down the route of taking more and more money away from the licence fee. So that's the area that I worry about, and that's why we've supported the government's proposals.
But Tim, this is what already happens for digital switchover with Liberal Democrat support. We're just saying this should carry on. And the point I would say about Virgin, just to come back to Stephen, if I may, on that, is that Virgin has a network that reaches the major towns and cities, 12.5 million households, but that is about half the UK population. And we were talking earlier about how we're going to connect to villages in Devon and Wales and Scotland and Worcestershire and much more remote places. The only organisation that has infrastructure to those places is BT. And it is madness to say that we're going to wait for BT to make this investment because they simply can't afford to do it.
Briefly, Stephen.
Well, that's because the economics haven't worked in rural areas. That's why we require the subsidy and we need it quickly, not waiting for another 3 years. I mean, Jeremy talked about regulatory change. Actually, the changes he's talked about are pretty minor tweaks, much of which are in hand with Ofcom anyway. But it's public support that's going to be required to make this happen in rural areas.
Well, it's clear that this debate and the discussions that are happening on the campaign trail that technology is no longer a minority issue. It impacts Britain's economy, it challenges our views on copyright and censorship and how we will interact with government, whichever party is in power, over the coming decades. However, this debate is not over. Do send your thoughts to guardian.co.uk/technology to continue the discussion on our blogs. Well, our three MPs have left the building, and I thought that we would have a brief discussion to find out what it was that our panellists thought about the policies and the politics of Labour, Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats. Charles, first I'd like to jump to you, because we didn't get nearly as much as we wanted to on the Free Our Data campaign, but tell me what it is that you thought about each of the candidates' attitudes to opening up data. Were you surprised?
I thought it was interesting that Stephen Timms said about the flood data, for example, which the Environment Agency holds on to very tightly. I see no reason at all why that shouldn't be online, which is, I think it's a quotable quote. The Tory policy, as I say, is one where Jeremy Hunt, as I think he admitted, isn't aware of the exact details that, you know, opening up Ordnance Survey master map is a great idea, but it's a really expensive one. You have to persuade the Treasury, and they are really hard to persuade of these things.
Does that suggest, though, that they're not as interested? Does that indicate that they're not committed to this?
No, it means that they've got lots of really big idea sort of things that are knocking around at Tory HQ, and I know that's one of them, but that actually when it came down to the really tough wrangling with the Treasury in a sort of environment where you're having to make enormous spending cuts, I suspect that putting another 80 million onto the Ordnance Survey's bank balance is not the sort of thing the Treasury would be keen to do. But I thought that Lord Razzle actually made a very good point, which is that you don't want it to be the job of a minister. You want it to actually be the job of almost a sort of activist within government.
Jemima, I'd like to turn to you now on some of the issues that we mentioned on the Digital Economy Act, specifically copyright. Tell me what you felt, how you felt that our three MPs, our MP3s, responded.
Our MP3s.
to the issue.
Lord Razzle is not an MP.
No, he's a Lord. But Stephen Timms said that he thought the introduction of letters by ISPs would reduce file sharing by 70%, which I think is very ambitious. Jeremy Hunt, I wish he wasn't conservative. Can I say that? He's very likeable and has an understanding of what he's talking about. You don't quite get that sense with Stephen Timms. And I know we shouldn't focus on personalities, but it is important. You can see that he really enjoys what he's talking about. And he did let slip that if there is such a thing as a Minister for Technology, if the Conservatives win the election, that he is up for the job. So
and
you heard
like
it here first.
Exactly, you'd like to step up. But in terms of the Liberal Democrats' attitudes, Lord Razzle was very keen on this idea of not focusing necessarily on the business models, but certainly making sure that, you know, that it was free and open, that people were able to share their music, that was actually part of the system that 13 to 20 year olds engaged in.
Yes, well, he gave Lily Allen as an example, and he was very concerned about the fact that younger people basically expect music for free. But I didn't feel he really had any improvement on what the Digital Economy Act as a way of actually sort of, you know, being the trousers to that mouth. If that makes sense.
Charles, do you have any concerns about how each of the parties propose to create their web blacklist, their filter?
Well, I think there's a fair way to go before that happens. And I'm not sure, actually. Jeremy Hunt may say that the Tories would want to revisit the Act and change things about it. I'm not sure, actually, that they'd do that, because I think they'd have all sorts of other things they'd really want to get on and do, especially in the first Parliament. And going back and revising some old bit of, you know, technology
new
Act.
New media tax.
Yeah, well, you know, something that got, you know, pushed through in the wash-up. I mean, the Dangerous Dogs Act is still in the statute books, and basically it gets ignored a lot. And that was a wash-up bill. So, you know, going back and fixing old legislation is not a high priority for any incoming government.
Well, you know, it's not inconceivable that we will have some kind of bizarre Whig and Tory mashup of a government, so we'll have to wait and see. There was one other interesting thing that Jeremy Hunt said, which was that just talking about the business models around the music industry, because we'd pushed him a bit on how much government had been lobbied by traditional media and music industry, and he said it's not government's job to protect old business models. It is government's job to protect artists. That was a very good point, and we can hold them to that next time there's a big lobbying issue.
Charles, you've focused quite closely in the past on the numbers associated with broadband. On this podcast, we've actually looked very clearly at what the realistic plans are for the 100 megabits per second and the 2 megabits per second, and how the Tories and Labour intend to roll out superfast broadband to the rest of the country. Do you think that their plans as they presented today are realistic?
Well, I think the Labour plans, where you'd have a sort of rural subsidy system, I think that's the easiest way of getting that done. The Tory proposals are much more about a real root and branch attack on BT, and that's the sort of thing that's really very ambitious, very difficult to do. You know, governments have come and gone and wrestled with BT, and not a great deal has changed.
And indeed, the Liberal Democrats, Lord Razzle, was also speaking out against BT as well. So there was a point of agreement there.
There is. Though I suspect that actually, if you really wanted to get fibre rolled out very fast, there's actually a slightly simpler fix, which is that new fibre, when it's laid down, for business use, gets taxed by the valuations office, and it attracts an amazingly high taxation rate compared to the fibre that BT has laid down. And it's all because of BT being an incumbent, having enormous amounts of fibre in the ground already, compared to these new companies which want to do it. And actually, I think that if the Tories wanted to, if the Tories were to be the people who are deciding about legislation, that actually tweaks to the way the valuations office does that would have a dramatic effect on fibre building compared to wrestling it to the ground and chopping it into little pieces.
Well, that's how they deconstructed the railways. Let's not go down that route, but, you know, doesn't
always
work.
We will not go down that route because we're an independent podcast.
Other parties are also available.
One of the concerns that we as a group and also some of our listeners had before we came to this debate was that we really didn't know a lot about the Liberal Democrats' policies when it came to technology. Do you feel now that you know more? Do you feel confident that you know what it is that they stand for?
Well, given that there was very little in their manifesto online, the current vogue is to say there's not a cigarette paper between them.
I think that really what's happened in the election, the way that Nick Clegg's popularity just is zoomed in the first debate, has basically caught the Lib Dems out. I mean, the fact that they sent a Lord rather than an actual candidate for an MP seat, I think is indicative.
Well, that's it for Tech Weekly this week. Many thanks to our special guests, Stephen Timms, Jeremy Hunt and Lord Razzle. You can read more about the issues raised by the candidates on guardian.co.uk/technology. Many thanks as well to Charles Arthur and Jemima Kish, and thank you very much to our listeners for your questions. Unfortunately, we ran out of time and weren't able to cover other hot digital topics like video games, privacy, and digital radio. If you'd like to talk about those some more, drop us a line on our blog. That's guardian.co.uk/technology. The program was produced by Scott Cawley. I'm Alex Krotowski. Join us next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.